Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome. This is another episode of New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Michael Johnston. I am your host. Today I have Sebastian Toutange with me today to discuss his new book, Intoxication and Ethnography of Effervescent Revelry, which was published by Rutgers University Press just last year, 2022. Welcome, Sebastian.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So, Sebastian, can we start off and could you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where you're working at, what your profession is, what your interest in research is.
Yep, sure, certainly. I'm an associate professor at Lund University. I'm an anthropologist and a sociologist, but actually, I mainly teach criminology, cultural criminology. We have this master's program at Lund University, where I invest most of my academic energies in that program. And as for research, I guess I have like two areas that I prefer to do research in these days. So one of them is nightlife, drug use, alcohol, and so on, which is what my book is about. And the other one, which is another domain, which is about street crime and extremism.
It makes sense, the pairing of anthropology and sociology with the nightlife and, you know, ethnography and just the approach that you took to this book. So that is very interesting. And so, Intoxication, how did you come about doing the study for this? Well, what turned out to be a book, maybe it never, you didn't know that going into the research, but what came out of it was a book.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this has taken me so many years. Don't even want to think about how many years this took me. So it started like way, way back when I was a student in anthropology. And then I got this student job where I was supposed to, you know, collect data on young people's use of drugs and alcohol in a small town in Denmark. And then I just saw this as a side thing, because what I really wanted to do was to study Buddhism in India. And I was preparing to do fieldwork there and everything. But then I just somehow got more and more intrigued in these young people that I was observing and talking with in this town called Ringsted, especially by this determined focus on getting really drunk. So in Denmark, it's mostly the drinking that's the main thing, not so much drug use, but just, you know, when you come and enter this field, you know, sober, doing systematic observation, talking with people, it just struck me that there's something super interesting in how we humans in many cultures intoxicate ourselves, and it's super destructive and yet also can be super pleasurable. So I really wanted to study that. And then it turned into my master thesis, and I continued studying it in different scenes, not only in the province in Denmark, but also in other parts of Denmark and in Bulgaria, even in Spain, with tourists going on a weekly binge. I guess, you know, looking back, the main driving question behind this is basically, why do we intoxicate ourselves? We can see it happens in all cultures at all times, that people come together for intoxication with or without drugs. And I find that, you know, fascinating. Why on earth do people do that? Sometimes people die from it, addiction problems and so on. So why do we do it? And that was the project it turned into.
And then a central theme that I saw throughout all of the chapters of the book is this concept of collective effervescence. Could you tell me a bit more about what collective effervescence is and how it is somewhat varied across different scholars and how they see collective effervescence?
Right. Yeah. So that concept became the key to my research eventually. I tried different other concepts and theories. You know, we have edge work, we have oceanic experience by Freud. We have many other tools that we can use to understand group intoxication, but collective effervescence is definitely my favorite one. It captures, and that would be perhaps the key argument of the book, it captures the essence of what people are searching for and sometimes experience when they come together for group intoxication, especially intensive forms of intoxication, such as festivals or nightlife resorts abroad and so on, and nightclubs. And what does it mean? So if we go back to Durkheim, he was the one, together with Marcel Mauss, who wrote about this and gave lectures about this more than 100 years ago. And so they began doing this 130 years ago, approximately. And then in the book Elementary Forms of Religious Life, which is, I think, maybe Durkheim's masterpiece, if one should mention one, from 1912. And there, collective effervescence refers to an absorbing group experience, an experience of profound excitement that involves some sense of being taken out of oneself and merging with some larger whole, the group, forgetting about oneself and so on. So if one pictures a crowd of ecstatic worshippers dancing around a bonfire or something, that's the kind of excitement that Durkheim had in mind with this concept. And he believed that this altered state, it is an altered state of consciousness, that it's essential to all religions. It's a sort of connection that people will feel when they fall into rhythm, performing a dance, a ritual dance, or swaying during prayer, or chanting to mantras and so on. So it's, we can find it in all religions, according to Durkheim. It's kind of the main religious experience. And at the peak of the experience, according to Durkheim and many who have kind of used the concept since, when people really connect with each other, they tend to forget themselves, daily problems, concerns about the future and so on, and just immerse themselves in the group. And then he also has, you know, a whole bunch of ideas of how this experience can open up to new ideas, and also that it will tend to be channelized into symbols that then come to stand for this magnificent experience as it can be. It can also be a dark experience, but he, I guess he mostly talked about the positive sides of this, although he was aware that things can go horribly wrong when people are excited in this manner.
And I don't even think that he had the opportunity to, in his life, to fully develop his conceptualization of collective effervescence, because I think to myself, if he lived a little bit longer, would he have tied it back to division of labor and, you know, the difference between organic and mechanical solidarity? And in a 21st century, with the heterogeneity of our society, is it difficult to have collective effervescence, and is that important stage? Forgetting about oneself and dropping out of society to see the group more than one's own personal differences from the rest of the group.
Yeah, no, you're totally right that he, you know, died soon after the publication of this book. He gave some interesting lectures afterwards where he was able to elaborate a bit and defend himself, because there were critics at the time. And they would, for example, one of his collaborators, Gaston Ricard, he wrote that Durkheim reduces religious experience to a sort of orgiastic state, this group state, and he ignored other kinds of religious experiences. And also Bronislaw Malinowski, the anthropologist, raised similar critique, and they were also agreeing that, you know, Durkheim, he doesn't fully develop a typology of types of effervescence. He hints at maybe two types at the most. But surely, you know, the effervescence in a nightclub is not the same as that, you know, around the totem pole or in the mosque or in the Hindu sect and so on. So what they call for back then in critics of the book is, you know, how does effervescence differ across social gatherings? And that problem, interestingly, has followed Durkheimian research up till today, even when we have, you know, big, magnificent books about effervescence, such as Randall Collins' work in Interaction and Ritual Chains, another masterpiece. even in that book, there's no attempt to kind of distinguish between types of effervescence. I think that's been kind of a hindrance to Duchamin research for decades.
And then Collins was probably the next big name that we think of when we think of collective effervescence in his ritual chains. Could you tell me a bit about his conceptualization and how it's different than Durkheim's original, and you know how Collins has made a name for himself there?
Yeah, you're right. I think maybe he is the main thinker today who has used and, you know, weaponized this this concept so it can be used to study a whole range of things, and it's really been taken up by so many researchers the way he reformulates it and the model, the theoretical model that he builds. And he's pretty close to Duchamin in his concept of effervescence, except for one, you know, huge difference, and that is that Collins extends the concept to cover instances of group excitement that occur on a day-to-day basis. For Duchamin, it's this unique experience that people feel a need to commemorate through storytelling and rituals afterwards. And it's like it's something that touches the very heart of society. It's not that often that it happens. And then Collins says, well, it does happen. It can happen during an engrossing conversation when we are physically together, and that there's this flow in interaction, and we can read signals from each other. And then we build up, stir up emotions, collaborate, you could say, in stirring up emotions. And then the magic of effervescence can happen in a conversation or during casual sex or during singing in the church, you know, on a lazy afternoon and on a Sunday and so on. It can happen on a daily basis. That's the big difference there. And I tend to side with Collins on this, that it needs not be this completely mind-blowing experience that happens, you know, once a year maybe. We can have small doses of it on a daily basis, and I think we need it.
You know, that's interesting. I didn't even think of Randall Collins in this way before, but you're talking about this, and I'm thinking of Howard Becker's becoming a marijuana user, and how there's some parallel there between the two scholars.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I think also the genius, I have Collins' book here on my side. I often have that. Is also that he builds this model of the causes and effects of effervescence. Where is it? It's on page 48 in my version of the book, where Collins is a sort of a positivist microsociologist. So he's very interested in the causes and effects of social phenomena. So he argues that what is needed to have effervescence. So first and foremost, group assembly. There needs to be at least two persons present, co-present in the same place, so physically close to one another. There has to be a sense of barrier to outsiders. There has to be a mutual focus of attention, and then a shared mood. So mutual focus of attention is that we, for example, during dance, we dance together, we're focused on the same beat, we become mutually aware, and we become aware that we are aware of the same thing, doing the same thing. And then the group magic can happen, where the group comes to understand itself as a group, and that's what generates effervescence. So this is part of Collins rethinking and rereading of Duchamin that's really brilliant and has proven so effective in empirical studies in the recent two decades.
And then your conceptualization that led you in your research collective drinking and the collective effervescence that took there. How do you conceptualize collective effervescence as something that happens in everyday life?
So the one problem with Duchamin is that he's French. I'm only half French, so he doesn't really define the concept that well, at least in his book. Then there were some speeches where he's a bit more specific. With Collins, he doesn't go much into effervescence itself. It's more the cause and effects, because he has this penchant for a positivistic approach to things. And I'm more interested in the experience per se. I have this phenomenological tendency in my work. So I'm interested in the experience. So that's where I go in and try to describe it. And then I also present a typology of types of effervescence in my data, which are about nightlife behaviors. So that would be my two main contributions to this theory, I guess. And so I understand effervescence, the experience, as having five experiential components. First, and most importantly, there's this powerful feeling of connectedness. That's the kind of the key of being part of a community, a common body. That's key. Without connection, genuine human connection, there's no effervescence. Then it's something else. Then it could be just excitement, or you can you know, do a video game online with your friends where you get all excited, but it's not effervescence if you don't have connection. Second, there is an intense rush of emotions that carry people outside of themselves. It has to be intense. It makes them forget about the humdrum and stresses of everyday life. Third, there will be some transgressive urges emerging that make people do what they don't normally do, say what they don't normally say. It can range from, you know, innocent breaches of convention to law breaking and so on. And fourth, the energies of it all tend to be channeled into symbols that then come to stand for the experience and the group that generated the experience. I can maybe go into these five elements more one by one if you want. The final one is that people come out of this with a sense of purpose, vitality, solidarity, and unity that makes life worth living. We need this. So would you like me to go more into each of these elements? Because maybe it's a bit abstract to just...
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah, I think that then our listeners could take that material and be able to have a better understanding of what you're writing about and how you were seeing the different scenes that you were when you're doing your ethnography.
Great, yeah. Perfect. And then, I mean, also, it's good to think about one's own experiences of connection in one's life, whether it's in nightlife situations or in a church, a mosque, or on the football stadium, if one can kind of tune into that emotion, that's helpful for understanding what we're talking about here. But so if we look at the first component here, the connection, then effervescence, the crux of it is to feel closely connected. And for Durkheim and, you know, Durkheimians, there's something inherently meaningful in meeting new people, getting close to them, moving to the same beat, singing to the same beat, sharing emotions and so on. And not only because we can obtain stuff from it, like we can network, or we can obtain long-term friendships or a partner and so on, but also just for the sheer pleasure of it in the here and now. So connection in order to connect, period. It's not some kind of project where you do something in the here and now to obtain something in the future. It's also its own reward in itself.
Oh, an end, not a means to an end, but an end in itself. Yes, it makes
exactly
sense.
Yes. Yeah, so it's this autotelic experience, the complicated word there, but you know that I have to look up repeatedly to understand it. But exactly, that it's an activity that is its own reward. That and it sure is. And then typically, people will feel, when we interview people about this, they will feel connected with other humans. That's the most important stuff, that you feel intimately connected with people. But sometimes people will also say that they feel connected with nature. At raves, for example, outside in nature, that there might be a connection with animals or the wider universe. So this connective feeling sometimes extends beyond the community of humans, but the human connection is kind of the most important one, and what people mostly talk about when they try to describe this, which is difficult. It's difficult to interview people about it because it's an experience, and how do we put words into it? Then intensity, as I mentioned, would be the second key element of this experience, and if we think about the sensations that arise when a superstar goes on stage at a concert. You know, you're there, maybe with a beer in your hand, talking with your friends, and there's a simmering of energy in the room. And then all of a sudden, Rihanna or another star comes into the scene, and you could just, it just explodes with energy. So that's kind of a full expression of effervescence, where people kind of connect with the icon, the energy star up on the stage, and then feel mutually connected, and the emotions just turns into this whirlwind that runs through the crowd. That's kind of energy implied. The transgressive part is, I guess it's only natural when people enter these states, and then people will feel emboldened to cross boundaries, that they can do stuff that they usually would not dare doing. So there's this experimentation, boundary crossing that tends to take place. People explore themselves and each other. They try out new ways of being, see the world from new perspectives, live out potentials that normally lie dormant, are kept away from public view, and look into aspects of themselves and aspects of existence that tend to be ignored, repressed, or forbidden in their normal lives. And part of what I like about the Duchamean tradition, which also counts Georges Bataille, Michel Mafazoli, and Randall Collins, is that transgression is not something that's necessarily bad. It's just something that we humans sometimes do. It's not necessarily something heavily sinful. If we look at children, for example, they transgress the rules that adults set up all the time. And it's a natural part of growing up that we get a boundary, we get a rule, and then we breach it in order to figure out where is the rule, where is the boundary. So we cross it in order to become aware of it and know where it is, and also what the consequences of crossing it is. And if we relate it to nightlife behavior, then this systematic crossing of boundaries that you can see if you enter a nightclub or a festival, people talking silly, behaving silly, or doing daring stuff, it can be seen as a systematic investigation of the rules that we live by in normal everyday life. And then maybe people can figure out if they want to live by those rules or if they want to establish new rules and so on. So it's a natural part of especially youthful youth life, children's life. But of course, then obviously sometimes people go too far, and sometimes also way too far, and that also happens, that things go awry. Effervescence is potentially dangerous. It's always risky, and sometimes, you know, there will be abuse, there will be fights, there will be people overdosing on stuff or getting into accidents and hurting themselves and so on. So that's part of the picture, that it can go awry for sure. The fourth element, this symbolization thing, is the most complicated one, I think. But let me try to explain. So when we have this, let's picture the concert, then people get pumped up with all these energies. And most of this energy is invested in the moment to make it more pleasurable. It's not that people would try to save up energy for the next day or try to get something out of it for the future. And yet there is a tendency for some of the energies to become channeled into what Duchamp would call sacred objects, such as a totem symbol or, you know, Rihanna's autograph, if you can get that one, or a picture of you and her together, or something else. It could be anything that turns into a symbol of the experience. So these symbols, these effervescent symbols, become repositories for the collective energies. They're like batteries that can be used after the celebration to evoke some of the effervescence that happened in the past. So when people take out the autograph and show it to the friend or the picture, or then they will kind of feel it. You can, you know, holiday pictures of you know, from Ibiza or Cancun or wherever, where there is effervescent moments depicted in the picture, when people see it and share it and share stories around it, they reconnect with those energies. So that's kind of a mechanism in in effervescent moments that Durkheim he observed, and it's kind of been shown again and again that's something like this happens, that we come out of this moment with symbols that carry memory traces that can help us connect with those moments. And people really want those symbols. They want those pictures or items that can help them reconnect with their past effervescent moments. Yeah. And so that's, I don't know, did I explain that okay?
I think so. We live in the moment through a symbol. I think of maybe even a jersey that a person might wear to a football game, or something like that, to remember the past experience that they had with their friends. Or I think about some of the NFL games now that you go to, or baseball games even, and you can buy a beer. But not only do you get the beer, but you get to keep the cup, and then the cup reminds mm-hmm. you of the experience that you had with your friends.
Yeah. And we just intuitively know that these items are important because they can connect it with these experiences. And some thinkers kind of discard this as trivial and not that important. But these items can be super important to people. If you are a fan of some soccer team and you wear those symbols, if you're a big fan, you wear them to funerals, you wear them to weddings and so on. It's not just something funny. It's important to people too, because they can connect people with effervescent moments and the community behind that moment. And that's why people will die for their community symbols. Sometimes they're soldiers dying for the flag, running into a bullet range, pull out a piece of cloth, but it's not just a piece of cloth. It's the flag of their group that they have, through rituals, invested with the energies when they salute the flag, when they gather around it, and so on. So symbols are something that people will die for, because they are generators of social solidarity and community.
And it's infused with energy, right? I mean, just as you're talking about, the symbol is infused with energy, and it can be positive or negative energy. I think about the, all of a sudden the team starts doing poorly, or the team does something against your allegiance, people burning jerseys after a player leaves the team or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so people will have hot emotions when they see somebody burning their symbol or stomping it. We have many contemporary examples of that. So good, because that symbolization element is a bit difficult to get your head around if you're not used to this kind of theory. But good, we nailed that one. I'm happy it came across okay here. So the final element would be revitalization. So the book, by the way, has a chapter on each of these five elements. And if we go back to Durkheim, he saw effervescence as something necessary and irrepressible. And we also see this in Collins' work, that effervescence is something that we need just as much as we need a sense of safety, food, and so on. Without it, we grow paranoid, depressed, and anxious. We could see that during the corona, where people couldn't connect that much with each other, that for many people who were isolated, it was a magnificent problem, right? That we need some kind of effervescence. Wherever we get it from so many different places, but we need it. It's a fundamental human need. So Durkheim was quite clear on this, and he... I share this conviction that effervescence has potentially edifying qualities, and I believe it's crucial to cultivate a deeper understanding of these qualities if we are to make better use of them. But of course, again, effervescence is and always will be risky. It can be dangerous if states of effervescence take hold of people in unsafe environments. Especially when we're dealing with very young people who tend to be pretty bad at taking care of themselves and things go wild. So I think as a society, we really need to think about, where do people today get their shot of effervescence, like the big full-blown effervescence? Well, it's very much in commercial settings, in nightclubs, also football stadiums, of course, and some in religious institutions. Politics also now is a growing arena for effervescent moments. So we have to look into who are controlling effervescence today and how can we as a society become better at, so if we talk about nightlife, at having effervescent revelry that is less focused on heavy drinking and drug use and more focused on music, maybe dancing, healthy activities, and not just, you know, heavy binge drinking, which would be the kind of substance that drive much effervescence in the Nordic countries where I come from, and in the country you come from, Michael. Yeah.
So now that we have a strong foundation of what collective effervescence is, everything from the stages of collective effervescence to the necessary components of collective effervescence, what do you think some of the most interesting parts of the research that you did with drinking in Denmark were? What were some of the experiences that were most interesting to you?
The most interesting parts of my fieldwork would definitely be in these nightlife resorts, Sunny Beach, Golden Sands, Ibiza. In the States, you have Cancun and Fort Lauderdale in the past and so on. I guess it's not anymore a big nightlife resort. But so that are these places where people go to party intensively for a week or two. And those settings were really interesting for me to observe and be there and see how people, you know, they become destabilized during vacations like that. I found that very fascinating. And that can be fun and fulfilling for many people, but for some it causes, you know, anxiety. And I met a few who had a psychosis in Sunny Beach, or that's what, I'm not a psychologist, but that's what it seemed like. And all these extreme experiences that people pursue for pleasure and can be super destructive, and yet we somehow need it in some form or other. And I don't know, but also an interesting thing that I hadn't read about in the literature, but just for these settings, is that many of the young men who go to these places, they buy sex from sex workers. I had not read about it before. We did a survey about it. I can't remember exactly the numbers, how many went to buy sex during these vacations, but it was a lot. Many went to strip clubs, which is very uncommon in Denmark, and went pay for sex. And, you know, 18-year-olds, 20-year-olds, young men. And so that surprised me. And when I started interviewing people about it, it was interesting to see that it was not because it was particularly pleasurable when they described these experiences. It was full of even, you know, disgust and craziness. And so I think a big drive to do it was to try it out and also to get a good story out of it, because that's also part of these behaviors, that people want experiences that they can then later talk about, tell about to friends, selected friends who will not judge them too harshly for what they did.
And it was over several nights. I remember the story of almost like going to bed drunk and waking up and going right back into the drinking practice again in some of these circles.
Yeah, it's it can be quite overwhelming. And some of the younger ones, I remember a conversation with a young woman who had panic attacks, and so she was, you know, certain that somebody had spiked her drink with drugs. And then I just went through, okay, what have you done during these last 5 days that we've been here? And it was continuous drinking, almost no food, you know, pizza slices here and there, a burger, very little sleep, and so on. I was like, maybe your drink was spiked, and, you know, I have to watch out for that. But maybe it was your intake of alcohol and junk food and lack of sleep. It can do pretty heavy damage on you if you don't take care of yourself. And so many of these young people, they didn't fully understand that before. They didn't know about this.
But that's what people came there for, and without such party experience, vacationers wouldn't be going there.
Exactly. It has to be wild. You don't go to sip juice and play with Lego, as another tourist said.
So then, there was pro so I'm hearing that there might have been a specific cohort of people who would go to these places for the experience. You were saying some of the younger people. So was there a specific demographic that you found yourself seeing more often than others?
Yeah, so if we focus on this Danish study, which is where I have most of my data from, they were middle class, on the track of getting a decent educations and having good lives. It was not marginalized individuals. It was people from good backgrounds with the future ahead of them. So this whole idea that it's escapism, that people drink heavily to escape from the burden of life and to forget things and forget their miserable lives and so on, that was not really the case with these Danish people that I studied. They're pretty happy with their lives. Of course, life occasionally is not fun at all for all of us, but it was not escapism. It was first of all an embrace of communal states of effervescence. It was, and of course, you can see it as kind of both. If I should not simplify things too much here, that you pursue these experiences as a movement away from the dullness of everyday life. Yeah, that's that to it, of course. So it is, in a sense, some sort of escape, but it's also very much an embrace of the community and of these wild experiences and all the good stories that come out of it. It has this dual nature, I think.
You call it communal, so it has a cultural element as well. So it's not something that is, completely taboo necessarily.
No, yeah, no. And there's so much talk about these experiences before it happens that people will tell stories about those who have been there to the novices, showing pictures, and then you go there, and people possibly want to get a wild story in order for to have it in the future. It's quite reflective, so you might call it a kind of reflective immoralism going on there with some mindfulness of the future narrative potential of what's happening.
So, were there any experiences that you had while you were doing your research where you thought maybe it's time for me to pick up and go home as a result of what you saw, or maybe reflected on whether or not you were having some sort of an impact on the behaviors that were taking place among the groups you were, part of, hanging out with?
Yes. I mean, always when there would be fights, there would be people getting hurt. There would be the first year I was in Sunny Beach. I actually, it was part of my PhD project to go there, and I wanted to, because a lot of the research on youthful drinking and nightlife tourism is problem focused, very much. So I wanted to look into the pleasures. Why do people do this? What kind of pleasures are involved? That was kind of the question before I really arrived at the theory of effervescence. And then the first year I was in Sunny Beach, there were four young people who died. I think it was four, three or four. One person who drank so much, he was 17 year old and he died. I was supposed to be on that pub crawl. I knew somebody who was family with him that I was with when it happened. He drank, he vomited, and then he kind of choked in his own vomit. So that can happen if you drink extreme amounts of alcohol. So horrible things like that happen. Also, a Swede who was killed by some bouncers due to some stupid conflict, and so on. So I saw these horrible things that made me realize, okay, my project can definitely not only be about pleasure, but has to also look into these dark forms of effervescence that are clearly there in environments like this. But it didn't want me to go away or go home, I think, but more made me more curious and you know, determined to kind of carry through with this and write about it.
So what's your what do you think your next steps will be? Are you going to continue this research in Danish countries, or do you find yourself probably moving on to the next topic, moving on to your next study?
Yeah, I'm probably going to work on a bit of different things, gangs in the Nordics. But regarding this topic, I want to go a bit ahead with this typology of effervescence. I think I need to do a bit more on that. I have it in my book, this these different types of effervescence. But together with Professor Philip Smith from Yale University, we are assembling an anthology with chapters about effervescence in different contexts, online, ayahuasca users, graffiti writers, rioters, and many other topics where we want to, part of the project is to figure out, okay, how does effervescence differ across cultural contexts and across gatherings, sizes of gatherings and so on. I think there's more to do there.
So is that one that you have a call for papers that's actively open for people to contribute to? Or is it one that you're going to invite specific people to?
Well, if anybody has a good idea, please do get in contact with me. I'd love to hear from you all. We have found the chapters, I think. So it depends a bit on the editor, which we haven't found yet. Will we have 10, 11, 12 chapters, or is there room for more? So we have those. I think we have 11 chapters now. But who knows? Maybe there can be another volume. I think there's much more interesting stuff to be done here. I'm just thinking also, why haven't somebody written more thoroughly about some of the attacks on congresses that's happened in the U.S. and in Brazil, on Capitol Hill in the U.S.? Lots of effervescence there. So Randall Collins has written an interesting chapter about it for sure, but I think we need more research on this and what happens on the ground when people pump up the energies and when situations of in-group love and merriment turn violent.
When I think of things like AI, artificial intelligence, and how that contributes to a collective effervescence, whether it supplements it or enhances it, or what role does AI play? And, you know, it's very
exactly.
Adolescence. Yes.
I just had an exchange with Philip Smith yesterday about this, where there was somebody who tried to attack the British Queen after intense interaction with an AI robot. So the robot kind of stirred his emotions to a point when he, you know, felt maybe in love with this robot. I don't have all the data from this situation, but what he did was to, you know, almost try to carry out an attack on the Queen. So is it effervescence? We don't know yet. But definitely a stirring of emotions in an interaction that can lead people to do good stuff, heroic stuff, but also barbaric stuff.
And then internet I'm always fascinated by, because being in rural Iowa, there's, you know, this CCTV that I'm currently looking at, where I can be anywhere I want to be on the internet, and I can watch what's happening without having boots on the ground, without having to travel all over the place. And I think to myself, can collective effervescence be observed from a distance? And I regularly get caught up in Goffman, because Goffman was all about face-to-face interactions, and also another guy who died too young without being able to experience or enlighten us on what he thinks about internet.
Yeah. So that's one of the huge questions for future research, and hopefully in the near future, is these online technologies. How can we study effervescence with them, and also? So Duquesne would have it that we need to be co-present physically to have effervescence. Collins is on the same page. I am too. But I think we need to be open that we can have effervescence, perhaps. We need data on it when we're alone in front of the screen. If, you know, through gaming, for example, surely there is excitement. That's obvious. Everybody who've seen that can see the excitement. But is
and
there
a sense of presence and being there? You are there physically and mindfully.
Yeah. So that's something there that we need to figure out. But my position for now is that being physically co-present just exposes us to a bombardment of stimuli from we can look, touch, smell, all these senses that are being activated in interactions where we're in the same place that technology today doesn't allow for. We can't smell people online yet and so on. And so I go with Collins and you came on this, that well, full-blown effervescence, you need to be in that same place. I think so.
And Zoom would be a good data point to start at, right? Looking at the Zoom classrooms and whether professors could get their students all on the same page to drop out in the classroom.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. This has been great. I really appreciate your time on the show today. But we have time for any last words or any last ideas that you would like to share with everyone.
Please get in contact with me if you want to discuss effervescence. I'm very open to that. All things effervescence is in my interest and probably always will be. And then thank you so much for inviting me to this show.
And I'll put Sebastian's contact information in the little write-up. So please, as you said, get in contact with them with any questions or contributions you'd like to. And again, this has been another episode of New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. Have a great day.